Okay, we are here for another Channel 9 video here, folks, to talk about debugging in the context of AppCompat and the tools that are available to you. Go ahead and introduce yourself, guys.
Sure. My name is Chris Jackson. I'm the technical lead on the Windows Application Experience SWAT team. Our job is to actually go out and visit with the largest of the large enterprise customers and look at the applications that are not working on Windows Vista, figure out why aren't they working, and what can you do to fix them. So I spend a lot of time both in a debugger and in fix-it-up mode.
Cool. And over here, the man who seems to have all the questions on internal aliases answered.
Hi, my name is Gov Maharaj. I work in Windows Core under application compatibility. I'm one of the developers that actually debug issues during the release cycle of every Next OS. And I basically investigate applications, reverse engineer them to figure out what's going on, and find where they're breaking in the OS.
So essentially your job title could be one smart cookie.
Occasionally. Yeah. Sometimes my title could be, "Dear God, what is he doing?" yeah, he's just winging it. I'm constantly learning, so every new OS is a new learning opportunity for me, as well as everybody else is using it.
Cool. So, let's go ahead and dive in and talk about, we've had other Channel 9 videos on debugging, whether it be C++ or .NET code. What's so different about debugging in the context of investigating an application compatibility issue?
Well, when you're talking about application compatibility with a new version of Windows, it's inherently different from the start, because in traditional debugging, you know, you typically have the source code sitting there. And you're typically looking at what did you do wrong in your source code, right? Because if you think the problem is in the OS, there's a 99.995% chance that you're probably wrong. It's probably somewhere in your code. But if you've got an application that used to work and is no longer working, well, what's different? The app is the same. Windows is different. So that entry point between Windows and your application suddenly has a vastly different priority. All of a sudden, that's where you're looking all the time. Where am I going in? What am I passing in differently? What's coming out differently? You know, I'm looking at, well, maybe I'm going to have two machines side by side, one running the current operating system and one running the new one, so I can look at the differences between what's going in and what's going out and try and sort out what's going on and learning what's happening. The other big difference is you almost never have the source code, and you're lucky if you've got symbols. So you're basically looking at a lot of assembler and a lot of entry points and trying to sort out what's happening so that this no longer works.
That sounds fun. No symbols and no source.
Yeah. Well, you're trying to spend as little time as you can in a debugger, right? And this is one of the things that we, you know, and I'm sure that you guys have the same issue, you know, is teaching people to get in and out quickly. Go in with a hypothesis, right? And this is when John Robbins teaches his class. This is what he always talks about, right? Make up a hypothesis. Go in with your debugger to prove or disprove that hypothesis and get out. And you're done.
Cool. So, it sounds like there's an interesting challenge when it comes to finding AppCompat issues. If you're minimizing the amount of time spent in a debugger, what kind of other tools are you going to be using to find these issues?
Well, we build a lot in the Windows team. The Application Compatibility Toolkit is the source of most of that, right? So, if you're looking at, you know, what's one of the biggest issues that we have? UAC, running as a standard user, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why are things no longer working? Well, I've got a couple of really great tools. One that comes out of the toolkit itself, Standard User Analyzer, and then another that comes out of the services organization, which is Lua Buglight, which is if you're running Standard User on XP, it's optimized for that scenario. Standard User Analyzer is optimized for I'm running as Standard User or Protected Admin on Vista, optimized to detect issues in that scenario, right? And that just requires you to run your app. You don't have to, you know, go in and do any debugging or do any work, just run the app, it'll pick up the issues and tell you, here's what's wrong. Oh, and guess what it can also do? It can recommend ways that may very well just fix it.
So it might be able to say, hey, you're trying to write into this part of the Hive. You know, that's not allowed as a standard user.
Right.
That's the problem.
Right, or, you know, you're doing an explicit admin check, right? We have a lot of mitigations built into the operating system that'll fix those issues, right? But the very first question that it asks is, are you an admin?
Right.
If the other things are all fixed up by the mitigations built into the OS or other mitigations that you can apply, right, then you truly don't need to answer yes to that question. But the problem is they've asked the question.
Right.
Right. So now you can put in this shim, which is called force admin access, which just lies about it. It's my favorite kind of shim. Are you an admin? Yes.
Huh. That's
real Windows source. source code, right?
Right.
The you know, force admin access shims up the API for is user and admin.
Mm-hmm.
The code for that? That's the code. That's real Windows source code right there.
Let's look at that, folks. Wow.
Right, so, I mean, it's that kind of thing that we can do to get past that, right? And we'll go into some details on shims a little later. I want to kind of talk about debugging first, right? But the idea with the mitigations that we put in there that are baked into the OS is that we don't let you do something you couldn't normally do, right? So we don't take a question that you ask that we'd normally say no to and say yes to. But what we will do is we'll ask a different question, right? Or in this case, just not ask a question at all to get past that. So now with this tool, I can not only see what the problem is, I can see what the fixes are, right? Another example, you know, I'm looking at an issue where here's this application that used to have a white background, and it's always had a white background in every version of Windows they've run. And they run on Vista, and it's got a black background, right? And I'm sitting there looking at it, right? None of my tools cover issues like that. So I'm like, okay, I'll poke at it with the debugger. And I'm poking around, I'm looking at all the visual APIs, I'm looking at, you know, it's not using UX theme because it's running on Windows 2000. And I'm trying to think of, you know, all the different, you know, get sys colors and all that, you know, all those different ways to look at it. And eventually I'm like, well, this is a VB6 app. And VB6 is pretty well known and a lot of defined entry points and somewhat similar to .NET. I wonder if someone made something sort of the equivalent of Reflector for VB code. And turns out they had.
Interesting.
So I went out and grabbed it, and I popped it open, and I said, look, you know, what did they do? They set the background color of the form equal to title bar text. Don't ask me why, but they did. Right? So then you start looking at, well, what's different about Windows Vista in terms of its title bar text, right? Windows 2000, you had the blue background with white text.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Windows 95, blue background, white text. Right? Windows XP, blue background, white text. Windows Vista, glass background, black text. And, you know, in 2 seconds, I looked at that and go, oh, here's the problem. You know, and unfortunately, I don't have a fix for it other than change your title bar text color.
Right.
But, I mean, you're always looking for some opportunity to short-circuit that investigation, right? Or even just throw a shim on it. I mean, mm-hmm. you probably run into a lot of situations like that where you just, if the shim fixes it, you've now narrowed down your issue right away.
Yeah, that's basically true. I mean, with the toolkit side of it, you know, they've got the shims already available. On my side of it is when we're debugging it, the shims haven't even been created yet. That's what I do, is actually write the shims, debug it down to what the actual failure is, create the shims that can get consumed by the toolkit and by anybody else that requires them.
So one word we've been saying a lot here is shims. I mean, for those developers out there, what are we talking about shims? What are shims? How do those relate to the OS and applications?
Well, we can kind of draw how this out. But basically, it's API interception, right? And which is kind of a lost art, it seems. Although Richter, they just released a new version of Richter's book. I don't remember the guy who sort of picked that up, that wall. But, you know, Richter talks about that in his book. It used to be Advanced Windows. And they finally put out a new edition. I mean, even though Richter's turned over to the managed side and hasn't turned back, that is such an invaluable resource, but talks about how to do API interception. But the idea is, right, when you're linking, here's your application, and it links into Windows somehow, right? Here's Windows. Right, somewhere along the line, Windows is going to be the same regardless. We're going to use the same DLLs across all these different processes and have them all mapped, and that's, you know, all known and documented. But the idea is for this application, when it wants to call into a Windows function that's implemented inside of this DLL, we want to keep track of where that is and be able to update. Then we do that using the import address table, which is in the Windows PE headers for the executable file. And it's going to say, hey, for, you know, kernel 32, you know, Bing create process W, you know, where is that? Well, it's in this module, wherever you load this in memory, plus some offset. So the loader comes along, and it's like, okay, well, I need to map this to, you know, this kernel 32 object, whatever it may be, or what any other Windows DLL object that I'm linked to. So I'm going to take the starting point when I load in that DLL into memory. and I'm going to add the offset, and I'm going to find that function. So when my app calls the function, it'll say, what's the address? Bring me over to the function. Which gives us a great opportunity to come in and say, you know what?
Here's this new offset.
Let's go somewhere else, right? Let's go to another address, you know, so I can say the address of my ship, which is sitting over here. And we can also give the shim the address of the function in case we need to use it, right? Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. If I'm shimming up get version to say, hey, I'm Windows XP, I'm just going to return 5.1 regardless. I don't need to ask Windows what it version it thinks it is, because I don't care. I'm going to always say 5.1. But if I'm going to call in and allocate some heap memory, I need some help from Windows to actually get memory. So I'm going to just rephrase the question and pass it over to Windows. So now, even though I'm doing something different, I'm still held by the rules of Windows. And if you see the boundary that we have here, to Windows, this is just more app code. It doesn't know that this happened to be written by the Windows guys. It just thinks, oh, the app's asking a different question than it used to ask, but that's fine, I'll rephrase the question. Which is why things like, you know, look at, you know, the, you know, correct file paths chip, right? What does that do? That says, hey, if you get a request to write a file to this path, replace it with this other path.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So to Windows, Windows may say, I'm not going to let you write to that path. Maybe it's an area that we don't cover with file emergency virtualization. So Windows would normally say, no, access denied. Right? Or maybe you're trying to enumerate, you know, a legacy file path, right? Like my documents. My documents isn't there anymore as an actual directory. We renamed it because, you know, why do you have to have MY space every single time? How silly is that? Let's just call it documents. But we knew that things were hard-coded, so we put in, you know, a directory junction at my documents to point there. But then we said, well, but if we just put in the directory junction and let you do enumeration, that causes some problems for us. Because now your backup software is going to come along, see my documents, back it all up. See documents, back it all up, and guess what? They're the same thing. So we say, deny read for everyone. Right? So if you're that breaks your app, and you've got that hard-coded, correct file paths can actually go through and fix that. And so now you're no longer asking for my documents, you're asking for documents. To Windows itself, it just thinks you just asked for that in the first place, because the shim come first. It thinks that that's the app's code.
So the shim is something that gets incorporated in my application when I build my application?
Yes.
Or is it kind of interjected for me?
It's interjected by the loader.
Okay.
So the shim itself will live in Windows. The actual code for it, the compiled code for it, lives in Windows. But we do a matching based on certain attributes of the application, the XE name, certain tags, vendor information, and when we recognize this application loading, it will look in a database and say, do I have any shims that I need to apply to this? And it says, oh, yes, this matches. Let's apply the shim during loading. It'll inject itself and basically patch up the IET and say, instead of the app calling for the Windows APIs that it knew about, it's going to be redirected through our shim APIs.
So this database is maintained by us, Microsoft?
Yes.
Well, customers can also implement their own custom shim databases,
mm-hmm.
right, as many as they want. So if you look in the Windows directory, the Windows WAC app patch, you'll see sysmain.sdb. That's ours.
Mm-hmm.
We push that out, you know, at RTM, and then we update it via Windows Update. Inside that directory is a subdirectory called custom. So an enterprise can go through and create their own matching information to say, oh, well, this shim fixes up these apps as well that I wrote. So I'll fix them up there, right? And then we talk about, well, then they could take a similar approach to what we do. They could, with their corporate image, they could distribute, right, a custom shim database that they can then update via their management software, be it System Center Configuration Manager, SMS, or Alteris, or all the other different options for doing that, the same way that we do for all the commercial software. Right? We added that because commercial software is only about half the story for a lot of enterprises. Right? We may fix up all the stuff you can buy off the shelf, but we can't fix the stuff that the only people who have it are you.
And they also don't have to wait for us to provide them with the new sysmain in a Windows Update or a service pack. If they're already aware of what shim is going to fix them, they can just create it and be on their way. What we really like, however, is for these large enterprises to report back to us what shims that they've applied to applications, because if we can incorporate it into our sysmain, then everybody that could possibly benefit from this would benefit.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So what are you've already stated a couple examples of shims. How many shims are, let's say, built into Vista, or what kind of shims are we talking about, and so on?
There are... Well, if you open up Compatibility Administrator, which is the tool from the Application Compatibility Toolkit that you use to apply shims, we hide a number of them by default, because a lot of them are, this shim is to fix this app's specific problems, and it's really not reusable. If you're
right.
not this app, we aren't going to do any good by exposing it. So we hide those. All total, there's 756, I think, of which 330-some-odd are actually something that you might want to consider reusing.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's obvious that Microsoft cares a lot about app compat, and we'll actually do our work on our side building the OS to make sure that current applications don't break as well as we can.
We really do go out of our way, and I suppose out of our way really means we do the best that we possibly can to make sure that applications don't break, because we understand that vendors are no longer available. They may not support the app, but consumers have invested a great amount of money into their applications. And we want them to buy the OS and have their applications work, because it's just better for everybody when that happens.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you probably have some good war stories of some of the links that you've gone through to resolve. I mean, one that I know of personally is a bug that I opened on Need for Speed Porsche Unleashed. I opened that bug. This is back in the XP time frame. And what it was doing, right, the actual behavior that we had to fix was, it was depending on the way that we implemented the Win9x heap. Which basically you would go in and you'd say, well, I work better the more memory I have for myself. So when I first launch, I'm going to ask for more memory. And at some point, I'm just going to fail on the 9x heap managers. And we don't fail anywhere near as early. In fact, we don't fail on the NT kernel until you're just out.
Right.
Right. And the behavior on, 9x, like, I got a lot of the memory for this game, as opposed to NT, where it's like, I have now no memory left for the rest of the system at all, is no longer good performance. It is, in fact, very, very bad performance.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a full emulation of the 9x heap that we implemented in the shim that even fails at the same places that we fail on the 9x heap.
Wow.
To get things like that working.
Right.
That brings up a really good point, actually. Some of the shims, some of the changes that we make in the OS are actually to fix bugs, obviously. Release an OS, we fix bugs in the previous one. A lot of applications have taken a hard dependency on those bugs. So a lot of our shims will actually re-implement those bugs so that apps can continue to work. And the heap is a very good point right there. We have another tool called Application Verifier, which part of its tool set is heap checking. That's one of the things that tends to change for every OS release. We tweak the heap manager changes a little bit. The restrictions usually get tighter, and apps tend to have leaks. They tend to have, just some interesting coding practices around the heap. So we highly encourage application developers to use the Application Verifier. It will detect a lot of these heap issues and will, I won't say guarantee, but will help maintain a better compatibility story going forward. You're more confident that an app that you wrote in XP that works under Application Verifier will work in Vista as well. We did make a lot of changes in Vista with the heap. We've had to apply that shim to a number of applications to
mm-hmm.
make sure that they continue working.
Interesting.
Yeah, well, App Verifier, yeah. The thing about App Verifier is it's very developer-focused. So when most of the people that we talk to on my team, we normally hit the IT pros first, because they're the ones who are in charge of the Vista deployment, right? And they need the help of developers. A lot of times, they don't always know how to get it, right? But if you look at something like Application Verifier, the average, IT pro is going to look at that and be like, where's the user interface? This is totally convoluted, right? It's sort of a set-and-forget type tool. It's really very different from, say, the Latch tool, which is designed with a solution in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not designed for the end user. It's designed for a developer. But if you look at the power, right, my stats are probably about a year and a half out of date now. By the time I last looked, about, I think it was like 67% of all application issues that caused an application crash that was reported. And you say, hey, do you want to tell Microsoft? And it goes into our Watson database. 67% of those would have been found if the developer of that software had run App Verifier before they shipped their code. Right? That's how we come up with the ideas of what other tests we need to add is what mistakes are people consistently making that are causing apps to crash. Because no one likes our apps to crash.
Right. So that's do you have a war story that you can share that that's the question is if it's shareable?
It would be actually very difficult for me to pick just one. We've had multiple different technologies we'll pick on. Okay, I remember this one time where an app, actually a technology, can I pick on SafeDisk here? A particular implementation of SafeDisk relied on having kernel 32 based at a particular address, and NTDLL had to be above that address. So if kernel 32, we do optimizations all the time, you know, each new OS, nobody's supposed to depend on base addresses.
Especially now that we mix it up with every OS.
So what happened was we changed the order. We said, okay, we'll load kernel 32 above NTDLL. It was a better optimization. Well, we found that SafeDisk broke because they were actually checking to see what the offset was of a particular API in kernel 32 and then doing a backtrack to NTDLL to make sure that they were in a particular range to make sure that they weren't being hacked or intercepted because, of course, you know, they're copy protection. They do a lot of strange things in the OS to make sure that everything is the way that they expect. That one took a good week to actually figure out that they were doing something like that. And we actually had to change the entire build process to say that no, NTDLL will always be above kernel 32 and their base addresses will always be within this particular range.
Interesting. Interesting. So have you found that other apps are breaking, do features like AS, the address space layout randomization that we do, do we find that that causes app compat issues or that we run into some of these new features that are?
For 99% of the applications out there, they don't cause any kind of issues. It's for the apps that take a hard dependency on internal structures. Some things that we don't document, like the system dispatch table, address offset, if they depend on a particular API always being after another API. So they walk the export table of kernel 32 and they manually walk it trying to find an API. That can change. They will fail. So usually if they follow real documentation, they're all good. It's when they take the internal dependencies is when they fail.
Cool. So getting back to the idea of tools with application testing or debugging of an app that's not working, is there a typical order that I might use the tools in? Or, I mean, depending on the problem, of course. I mean, what kind of tools might I lean towards first? Am I going to lean towards the ACT tool set before the debugger, before WinDebug?
Clearly, anything you can do to keep out of a debugger is going to save your time, right? I mean, there's no better way to suck away your life than just leave your debugger open, right?
Which is hard, since us developers love it.
Right. Well, it's one of those things that makes you feel cool. Like it can make you feel cool. I remember, like, when I first joined the SWAT team, one of the first things they had us do was they had us join Gov's team for a month, right? I came in there and sat there with my debugger for the first full day and solved the grand total of zero bugs. And I walked home that day, and I stayed there for, like, 15 hours, determined to close that first bug, feeling like I was quite possibly the dumbest person on the face of the planet. Because it's by the time it gets to to what used to be the AE bit team, I think they've renamed them. No one can, they didn't reuse more acronyms, right? So they have kind of a new name for the team. But, you quickly learn, right? I'm not just going to be able to leverage this debugger and just sling my way around. Like, some people can. Like, I've seen some people, right? Like, Robert is the example. Robert will just dump hex to the screen and look and go, oh, there's the problem.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, you know, what is going on there? I mean, some of these guys are absolutely crazy. But, you know, for me, get in and out as quickly as you can. And yes, there is some sort of lure, and if you start to learn some of the commands, yes, you feel a little bit cooler.
What's that hard
sitting
in
CDB, right, in a console window, as opposed to sitting in a graphical environment. But I personally like the Windows.
It's that hardcore lore.
Yes.
Maybe this will make me one step closer to Mark Rusinovich if I do this. Yeah.
Right. Well, Mark's the same way. If you look at his all of his case studies, right, he's always, you know, the case of the dot, dot, dot.
Right.
Right.
And he's always using his sysinternals tools.
He's using his sysinternals tools, yeah. Which are invaluable.
Yeah.
Right? So many things you can find with Process Monitor, right? You have or Process Explorer. You don't need to hit with a debugger, and you mm-hmm. may as well. The other thing you'll notice is that he'll get to the point where he knows who to assign the bug to, and he's done.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't keep going, and that's hard, because you're typically thinking, oh, I really want to understand this, and be able to say, this is the kind of code that you wrote, and the kind of code you need to do to fix it. But you don't actually have to do that. As soon as you have someone you can assign the bug to, you're done. There are plenty more bugs, right? We're not running out anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that's sort of a good piece of knowledge to know. One example of when I swung a debugger in and used it, I think, pretty efficiently. You know, we had an application that wasn't running with UAC turned on, which surprised me to no end because they were running standard users.
Hmm.
And I'm like, UAC is fixes, right? So how could UAC break something by being turned on if you're a standard user? I can understand if you're an admin because you go all of a sudden go from admin to protected admin, and you lose a lot of permissions. But a standard user, you go from standard user to standard user with fixes. How could that break anything? Hit it with a debugger and immediately saw, oh, you're opening a new process. I didn't do any assembly language dumps whatsoever. I'm like, oh, new process. That's interesting. And it was very temporal because it was immediately failing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had to think, why is it immediately failing? Well, they had set elevation to automatically deny for their standard users because, well, they don't have credentials, so why even bother asking them for it? We're auto-denying. Well, why was it prompting for elevation? Well, was it a setup? Well, no, because then, you know, it would have been detected either way, right, with setup detection. And what we eventually found is that their standard users, we found this looking at their group policy, their standard users weren't actually standard users. Their standard users were being assigned SE Backup, SE Restore, and the privilege to install kernel mode drivers.
Wow.
Which means, guess what? We split the token.
Yeah.
Which means they have these extra privileges, which they'll never get because they're going to automatically deny every single elevation request. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's not like it's doing them any good.
Right.
But they weren't actually standard users, right? What did I do with the debugger? Right. With the debugger, I went in and saw it's creating a new process. And that's my end of my use of the debugger. Then I started figuring out exactly why would this be failing, because it was manifested, right? You can crack it with Visual Studio and look at the binary and say, mm-hmm. oh, here's a manifest in the resources. So the developer actually did their job. And they were saying highest available, which should have worked, except they weren't really standard users.
Hmm.
And I'm done with the debugger, and I'm on and I've solved the problem.
Interesting. So if I'm a developer out there facing an app compat issue that's in front of me trying to figure out what's wrong, what's the number one resource, or what are, you know, the top resources I might leverage? Like, go grab the application compatibility toolkit and any websites or anything out there that I can go to get these tools?
In terms of tools, I mean, the application compatibility toolkit, the sysinternal stuff, I wouldn't go any. I have them on a USB key. I won't go anywhere without them, you know, in multiple copies and multiple locations.
Yeah. That's often my first install into a virtual machine. Put the sysinternals tools there.
Some imagination. I mean, if you're faced with a particular problem, you know, is it a crash? Is it an error message? You know, it's obviously some aberrant behavior, but you have to come up with some sort of theory. What does a working case look like? You know, find your divergent point. Other things to look out for are perhaps it's something that happened in the setup. You know, you have a runtime failure, your app won't launch. But the problem could very well have been during the setup phase. So it's all about, you know, working backwards from where you have the issue to possible divergent points. It's usually a little bit rarer to have things fail during the setup and cause problems later on. Usually the setup just blows up.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been known for some cases like an app setup says, what is the version of the OS? It gets back version 6. I don't know what to do with version 6. I'm going to say that you're NT. And we happily install the app as if it was NT. It'll install some binaries. Of course, there are NT-specific binaries. And then the app no longer functions on, you know, the current OS. So you have to go back and Yeah, you have to have a nice baseline comparison.
Cool. Well, unless there's anything else you can think of that we didn't mention. Anything? No?
Well, I mean, I'll throw Well, I mean, there's nothing better you can do, right? You know, one thing that I always make sure that I do is I always blog about the things that I find. A, because I can then go and find out about it later. And B, because, you know, if I'm writing about it, it's because you really, it wasn't something that you really want to do, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to say, you know what, it took me probably the better part of a day to solve this problem. There's no point in everyone else spending the better part of that day doing that, right? Because the when you talk about creativity, right, you can go through and read up on the application compatibility cookbook and know what to expect for the most part. Those are going to be all your big heavy hitters, right? But in a lot of organizations, you're going to have, you know, one, two, three real oddball, you know, out in left field ones, kind of depending on you know, how diverse your portfolio is, that are going to challenge your abilities, right? Probably the most challenging one that I found that I had to, and I think I actually went through you to find the right person to get hooked up, right? I'm looking at this, you know, application that won't install. Well, why it won't install was trying to register this COM component. Well, okay, great. I can extract the COM component from the MSI and take a look at it and just try calling Red Server 32, and it's failing. I'm like, well, why is it failing? Well, then you start thinking, okay, well, you know, let's dig back to the COM knowledge, right? We're just calling it the DLL register server, which you could implement arbitrary code in there if you wanted to, and that could be failing for some whatever compatibility reason. But I looked at it, and it's just implementing ATL code, saying ATL register to the server, which just pulls the type library out of the resources and does all the type library work to get it all registered the way that it ought to. So they hadn't written any code, and I'm pretty sure ATL still works. Right? So then I'm like, okay, well, what could be broken? The type library, you know? So I'm like, okay, well, what's it doing when it goes through and registers the type library? Well, let's get that under debugger with the theory of there's something wrong with the type library. We're watching it going through and iterating through all the attributes in the type library. And I happen to notice that the attributes are coming at 60-byte intervals. And then it calls a method where I can actually unassemble the function and say, well, what's going on in this method? And it's saying, is this a valid attribute? And the only thing it does in these like five lines of assembly language code is say, is this offset evenly divisible by 64? And I'm like, well, I just watched it incrementing by 60 as it went along, and then it asks, are you divisible by 64? Probably not, unless you get real lucky.
Right.
But I'm like, okay, well, I don't, you know, this is going back before my time, and then you hooked me up with one of the COM guys who's like, oh yeah, like a decade ago, we, you know, or more than that, we changed the type library format to add an extra 4 bytes of information, and we deprecated the old one in XP. But this customer was on 2000. So it didn't break on XP. So the people who remembered that it broke had forgotten that 5 years ago.
Hmm.
You know, and then the next question is, how do you fix that? I'll throw that at you. How would you fix that?
So in that particular case, we would actually write a custom shim to either munch the data coming back as 60 or changing the assembly, patching the assembly to say, yep, you're fine. We just basically fake it out.
Right. Yeah. Interesting.
But you can't write your own shims if you're a customer.
Right. So if you're a customer, we'd probably tell you to upgrade.
But what we actually did, we got it working.
Oh, did you get it working?
If you hit that with, what's the COM tool? I don't know why I'm spacing on the name, but there's a tool that you can use that will reverse engineer IDL,
mm-hmm.
right? And we'll show you what's going on in this component. And so I took that to a Windows 2000 box where it's a fully supported type library format and reverse engineered the IDL. Copy that to Notepad, drops it on my key, brought it over to my machine, which has a current SDK on it, and used MIDL, the Microsoft IDL compiler, to recompile the IDL, take the binary, pop the old type library out of there, and drop the recompiled one in there using the correct format,
right.
And boom.
And then
it registered, and it worked.
Huh, interesting.
But, I mean, it's that kind of like, A, I need to, you know, I had the advantage of being able to find the COM guy, but being able to figure out what's broken, and B, if you can't write a custom shim, can you still get this working somehow? And we'll do anything, right? There's all kinds of crazy stuff. I mean, you guys
as recompiling. In a way, it sort of counts as recompiling.
Right, but we didn't need to find the
original source.
The original source to do that.
Right, that's
true. Yeah, I mean, you guys do. I've seen you guys do some really crazy stuff to get around. Copy protection is the worst, right? And basically, I'll say if you run into copy protection,
sorry,
right, and you don't do this for a living, right, move on.
Right.
You're going to waste so much time. Right? Because they don't want you to be, I mean, even its mitigations are limited too. They don't want you shimming things up, right? Because mm-hmm. the last thing they want you to do is replace a call to, you know, is this app licensed.dll with a call to, oh yeah, of course it's licensed.dll. Right? So they actively prevent you from doing that. So if right. you can't fix it anyway, then why investigate?
Yeah,
usually in those cases we just have to change the OS to either revert back to the previous behavior or do very specific fix-ups based on a particular protection. As you said, that copy protections are very hairy at times.
So how does this plug into, if I right-click an application and look at its properties, I can say running XP compatibility mode or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
How does that... Does that play into my debugging at all, where I can say, okay, try to run it in compatibility mode, does it work? Or I think, how does that...
Well, that's applying shims. Into? Those are just shims. It's another entry point that we have to wire up a shim. You can create a custom shim database that will contain, you know, the mappings to say, well, this attribute with these properties should be shimmed with this, right? Which is much more general, designed to catch it regardless of where you happen to install it to. But if it's just on your machine, it's just based purely on the path. But it's the exact same shim code that we wire up. It's just we wire it up based on its existence in the registry, which is what those options do in the property page,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to in the shim database. But they both are going to get applied.
Ah, cool. Well, thanks, gentlemen. Thanks for taking the time to actually come film a Channel 9 video. And if there's any questions, we'll go ahead and post them on the thread on Channel 9, and we'll see you guys later.
Great, thanks.
Bye-bye.